Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 367. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. A big week for us as we just found out that we've been recognized with the Excellence in Podcasting Award from the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. This is a huge honor for us and the first time that they've ever given out an Excellence Award in this category, so we're very proud. One of the reasons we get to keep doing this show these many years later is that we have the wonderful opportunity to speak to incredible folks doing incredible things, and of course, this week's guest is no exception, so let me introduce him to you. Justin Sayre is a comedian, a performing artist, an activist, a writer, and the very definition of an entertainer. He is perhaps best known as the creator and host of The Meeting of the International Order of Sodomites. It is an acclaimed comedy variety show. I've seen it. So enjoyable. It was named among the top nightclub shows by Time Out New York. It received the Bistro Award for Comedy Artistry and a MAC Award nomination for Best Male Comedy Performance. Justin has been named one of the funniest people in Brooklyn by Brooklyn Magazine and among LA's 16 most talented LGBT comics by Frontiers Magazine. His debut album, The Gay Agenda, recently debuted on iTunes. Physical copies are set to be released online and in stores on Friday, September 16th. And I am not the only podcaster on this week's episode. Justin is a podcaster. Sparkle and Circulate with Justin Sayre, the official podcast of the International Order of Sodomites. Incredible interviews. It was named among the 10 comedy podcasts you should listen to by Backstage. So much ground to cover. But first, Justin, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh my God. You made me actually thrilled about meeting this son of a bitch. I thought, he sounds fantastic, and then I remembered it was me.
It's you.
Like, oh, yeah, that old queen. Bring her out.
We have so much ground to cover, Justin. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm ready.
So many titles that I've given you in your bio, comedian, performing artist, activist, writer. Is there one title that you gravitate towards more than others?
Well, I think of myself as a writer first. That's where it all kind of comes from. But I'm a performer, and yeah, I think of a writer mostly. I hasten to say activist only because I feel like I haven't been arrested enough to be an activist really properly.
And that truly is the barometer, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Call me when I've been in the slammer a couple times, then I'll say I'm an activist. Right now, I dabble. You know.
Just misdemeanors. Nothing that they've locked you up for.
Nothing that I've gotten locked up for.
Now, if we turn back the clock and looked at little Justin Sayre running around, was he quite the entertainer, quite the writer?
Well, I doubt first that I would be running.
Okay.
But, no, I was an inter... I guess so, yeah. I had very entertaining people around me. And I think just to keep up, you had to say something funny or why were you talking at all? So, yeah, I think I always had a sense of kind of wanting to perform, wanting to be funny. And I came from a long line of kind of Irish storytellers. So it was really always about telling a great story. And I think that certainly rubbed off on me.
There it is.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I have never looked at my interview question list and seen things that are so all over the map. I barely know where to go with this. Do you find that often?
I guess, but again, like, you know, let's be honest. I do a lot, but this is all I can do. I can barely function otherwise as a human being. I can't screw things in. I can't fix things. I don't even drive a car. So, you know, there's a lot that I can't do. It's just, you know, I do a lot of other things. I wish it was more concentrated, but I don't function otherwise, though. So.
That's like the beginning of your self-help book right there. That was inspirational.
I like the fact that I'm a barely functioning adult. I should write a self-help book. Do what you know a lot of. Just don't do the stuff you don't know how to do. Be very forgiving if you don't know how to do stuff.
Yeah. That's what comes after the colon. We have to work on what comes before the colon. But we'll work on that.
Absolutely.
We'll work on that.
All right. We'll put it in the soup.
Now, I mentioned the meeting. For folks who don't know about the meeting, which is one of the most fun nights that I have had there in the greater New York City area, tell everybody about the meeting.
So the meeting is the meeting of the official, the official monthly meeting of the International Order of Sodomites, of which I am the chairman. And it is a comedy variety show that celebrates the lives and legacies of LGBT people. We talk about politics. We talk about culture. We do a new ruling from the board, which is new laws and bylaws handed down by the board of the order. And every month we celebrate a different gay icon. So we bring together a bunch of Broadway people, a bunch of downtown artists to bring their own spin to the works of people like Diana Ross or Bette Midler or whoever we pick that month. And it becomes a way in which we see how the community as a whole really deals with a body of work or what that person means to them in an interesting way. So it's never a show about imitation. It's always a show about where we are as a community right now and how we're processing the world at hand.
And it's not only the eighth season, but, and I'm sure this is a typo, it reads here the final season. That can't be right.
It is the final. It is right. The final season. I know. Eight seasons in. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, first of all, let's pause. Eight seasons, that's pretty darn remarkable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's part of why we're doing this season, because it is really a victory lap for everybody involved in the show. We started out in the duplex kind of as a lark, whether this was going to work or not, 7 years ago. And since then, we've been through many iterations and had so many fantastic guests and so many different people involved with the show in amazing ways that we really wanted to have one last season while we're going out on top, while we've had three successful years at Joe's Pub selling out months in advance to celebrate what the show is, but also to kind of say a fond farewell to everyone that's been a part of making the show the huge success that it is.
Well, look, audiences get entertainment out of it. What do you, Justin, get out of doing the show?
Well, for me, the show initially came out of a sense of not having a platform to communicate about politics mm-hmm. and about the culture of being gay in the new millennium. I didn't know where we were really kind of doing that as a community and really processing it as a community, because I think at the cornerstone of what the show is, it's all about community. It's all about how we come together, how we don't, how we disagree with each other, and how we form this hodgepodge of an LGBT community. So the show was about doing it in a forum that really reflected that, we're all in this together. And for me, it was a great opportunity to give that voice, to kind of talk about serious issues, but also kind of bring it a moment of brevity to kind of make sure that I was checking in with the community and saying, hey, we're doing okay, but we could always do a little bit better. Yeah. And for me, that's been an amazing, amazing opportunity and an amazing gift that I've had for 7 years of being able to stand on a stage and say, this is what I think, and seeing how many people agree with me.
Yeah. Yeah. What has been the most interesting audience reaction that you have experienced doing this show?
Well, I was very anti-Nick Jonas for a little while.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, come on. But my audience did not care for that. They were very pro-Jonas. And it was the first time they ever really were like, you know what? You've gone too far, madam. They really booed me down. And I was like, you know what? All right. I've shamed you about everything else. I'll give you that, Jonah.
I have been doing this show and covering LGBTQ issues for 8 years. I had no idea that Nick Jonas was really the line that shall not be crossed.
Apparently. I had no idea myself. But that's the one people get real pressy about. They really...
It's amazing.
You show them abs and they want more.
Look at that.
You know?
Look at that. Can I tell you our very random connection that you and I share?
Oh, please.
Very random story. 1998, I'm a sophomore at NYU, and we share NYU in common as well. But
sure.
Sophomore at NYU, get a job as a singing waiter in the West Village. I barely had any idea what I was doing. I certainly wasn't a very good singer, and I was quite the terrible waiter. But thankfully, I made it through my first night and a few months of working there because the piano player was one of the most supportive people I've ever encountered. That piano player, Tracy. Tracy Stark.
Oh my goodness. Tracy Stark, she's amazing. She's
Isn't
been
she?
Our musical director for quite some time.
It's a good people.
And you would have to. She's an amazing woman.
Yeah.
You were lucky to have her.
I never would have made it through Orange Colored Sky without Tracy Stark.
Oh, believe me, I've said the same thing many times. No, she's fantastic. You were a singing waiter?
I worked.
That's my nightmare.
Yes. I think I made it the audience's nightmare as well. So everyone shared in that. I used to work at it was called the Oaks, which used to be the Five Oaks on Grove Street. And then I worked at the Duplex, but I got fired from the Duplex. So there you go.
Oh, see, I need a proscenium. I need a little lip that says I'm up on here and you're down there. I couldn't serve Cokes and then tell a joke. I couldn't do it. You kill me.
I find that suddenly Seymour brings us all together.
That's very true.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Yeah. You don't cross suddenly Seymour, and apparently you don't cross Nick Jonas. So there you
go.
This
don't.
Is what we've learned. This is
we've
what
learned.
We have learned. Now, as I said in the intro, I am not the only podcaster on here. I love your podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a lot of fun to do. It is really a lot of fun to do. And, I'm so glad that it's kind of picked up steam and people really look forward to it every month. Yeah, it's a real joy. And it all affords me, you know, a big opportunity because, you know, during the meeting, I have all these fantastic guests and performers and all that throughout New York. And I don't often get to talk to them on stage about the work that they're doing and the experiences they bring to the table. So it really presents itself as an opportunity for me to talk to people I admire and people I love, people I work with, about, you know, what they're doing currently. And it's proved really popular. We've been able to talk to some fantastic people, and the roster just keeps getting better and better.
Now, do you get starstruck ever?
Not since Elaine Stritch died.
Yeah. There it is.
Do I get starstruck? There's a few. I will tell this. So I met Stritch when she was alive, and she was the first person I got really, I couldn't handle how much I liked her, and I was obsessed with her, and so much. She's such a huge influence on how I perform, and that kind of like adroitness and honesty that she aimed with. And then, you know, I've met other people, and I'm kind of like, oh, hi. Like, the first time I met Meryl Streep, I was like, hey, Meryl, how are you? Like, nothing. And all my friends around me were like, oh, my God, you just talked to Meryl. Yeah, I got nothing for that. But you show me Stritch. I could never talk to Marion Seldes, who was the nicest woman in the world, you know. So it's different. I think there's different categories for it. But I tend to be okay. Though I will tell you, I work currently at the Warner Brothers lot.
Yes.
And across the street from where we film, Harry Styles is doing a movie. And I'm just, I'm wearing a burqa to work because I just don't want him to see me. I can't handle it. I don't want it. It's too much. So I guess I do get starstruck.
How would you approach interviewing Harry Styles on your podcast?
I wouldn't do it.
Okay.
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't talk to him. Or I'd just say, how does it feel to be my dream? Is it lovely? I wouldn't know what to say. I couldn't talk to him. Couldn't do it.
You know, one of the people that you've spoken to that I don't think I could speak to was Randy Harrison, just because I feel like I've seen every inch of his body. And so it's a lot. It's a yes.
Yeah, you have. But that's, I mean, I've known Randy for a while. Randy and I are great friends. And, you know, and one of my first questions to him when I first talked, I said, how is it to feel that there's a certain age demographic, like men over 30, every single one of them has masturbated to you. How does that feel on a day-to-day? He's like, it's okay. It's not bad. It's all right. I'm like, okay. Just as long as we have the go-ahead. But, you know, he's also one of the nicest, most talented and genuine people you can imagine. I mean, I just saw him. He was in L.A. doing, you know, he's doing the cabaret tour, and he was just fantastic. And you talk about warmth and you talk about genuineness. You can't find somebody better than Randy Harris, and he's really fantastic.
Again, listeners, we are here with Justin Serre, comedian, performing artist, activist with some misdemeanors coming up, and entertainer. Sure. Now, with the podcast, I know I've spoken to a lot of people who do this type of work. Occasionally, they encounter some very amusing technical difficulties. Has that happened to you?
No.
Look at that.
No, I can't think of anyone.
I love it. Great.
No. I mean, I hate to shoot you down, but no, just kind of go in and it happens. And even if they need, the worst that ever happens is we have 10 minutes where I talk in the beginning, and I do it kind of free form. I don't write much for it. And we've lost a bunch of those, and I had to do them again that moment, but that was the worst that ever happened.
That's not bad.
I was like, I guess I'll talk about something else. Okay.
We can just move on to a different topic then. That's fine.
Yeah, 10 That's minutes. Good. You know, we literally put on the timer because I can talk all night. So it's really like, go. All right. Hi, everybody. You know, and we go.
I love it. Well, here's the part of the show where I just have a list of random topics, and I'm not even going to attempt to smoothly transition because I don't know that I can. But here are all the random things that I want you to opine upon because I know it's things that you care about. You ready?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Billie Holiday, someone you like.
I love Billie Holiday. And Billie Holiday, you know, Billie Holiday with people like Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Carmen McRae really got me through my childhood. I wanted to move to New York and be a jazz singer more than anything in the world. And, you know, it's amazing to me how modern they all still sound, and in some ways how much we lose because you have a lot of lyrics aren't as important as I think they once were.
Yeah.
So for me, I go back and I'm listening to, you know, a Billie Holiday song from 70, 80 years ago, and she's still telling a real story about heartache or about loss.
Yeah.
And it hits you in ways that that very few artists today, I think, can actually do. And I think as somebody who is interested so much in story, I go back to those singers over and over again because they were all great storytellers. And she's one of the best. She's somebody that I just admire on end.
Nice. I heard you say in an interview you would love to go see Billie Holiday and pick up people with Tennessee Williams.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's the dream. Could you imagine, if I could go back in time, I'd go just for like a real dirty weekend in 46. You know, all those GIs home on leave, me and Tennessee Williams going around. Come on, that's sweet.
A dirty weekend in 46. I think we just got the title before the colon, so that's good.
There you go.
There it is.
A dirty weekend in 46.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's the self-help book. All right, next topic. Scarves. You enjoy the scarves and scarf placement. Tell everybody about your appreciation for scarves.
Well, I love it. I love a drape.
Yeah.
I love anything that's a drape, anything that's a fabric. It's getting to the point where I'm demanding scarves that are too, I'm almost wearing bed sheets at this point.
Okay.
I'm just wrapping them around because I like a trail. I like, also the thing with a scarf, and it's so weird, but the first day I went into this, the job that I work at currently, I went in and I had 3 scarves on. I don't know why. I don't even know how. But I took one off and I laid it across the desk and I made it in. Like, I just kind of decorated the office with scarves. And they were like, what have you done in here? It looks fantastic. I'm like, thank God I was wearing all this shit, you know? But I do. I have scarves all over the place. And I just like something that you can kind of, I like being a MacGyver of fashion, you know? I've turned scarves into bags. I've turned them into headdresses, anything. Because, you know, you never know what's going to happen during your day, and it's nice to have just a little extra piece of fabric in case things get a little sticky.
Yeah. And I could see you doing a pretty quality scarf flip. I don't know what we would call that. That thing where you just throw it over your neck kind of thing, you know? Where...
Oh, yes. Oh, I've learned by trial and error, you know, over decades of like, oh, okay, well... This doesn't, you know, and then you have to realize, because I think a problem that I have is in my head, I exist as kind of a 45-year-old Maggie Smith. I'm very lithe and small. And then I look in the mirror and I'm, you know, Oliver Reed on a hangover day. It's terrifying. So I really have to, sometimes I have to rein it in and be like, okay, you know what? This scarf place is not working for you. This is just, it makes your head look like an egg. Okay, we need to fix that. Okay, learn. You got to do a lot.
It's a lot. Now, this next topic. Now, I actually wrote about this next group a few months ago for the Huffington Post, and the crap that I got from all over the country writing about them. Talk to everyone about your feelings about gay Republicans.
I hate them.
Yeah.
I hate them. I can't, there's no, and I'm sorry you got crap about it, because believe me, anything you said, I've probably said worse and mean. I can't, There, listen, I have a real sense of two things, and I think they're really important when people, as a gay person right now, okay, I feel like I have a dog in every fight. So when women are talking about women's rights, I know gay people that are women. Mm-hmm. Some of my very close friends are women. And so that means I'm on their side when it comes to talking about misogyny.
Yeah.
So I can't be with a party that has a misogynist platform. And when I talk about, I have friends and people of color are part of my community. I can't be part of a party that with all their actions say Black lives don't matter.
Right.
And I can't be a part of a party that thinks that economics and education aren't important enough, because I see how that affects gay and lesbian people. So I don't think, when somebody says, oh, they're a Republican for fiscal reasons, I think, well, then you're really ignoring the human side of fiscal reasons. Because, you know, economics plays such a part in people's lives. And I also feel like they're ignoring, or they're choosing to ignore, a whole section of people because they don't feel directly affected by those people. And I do.
Yeah.
I do. My LGBT community has Black people, Latino people, people of color, people of different immigration statuses, people of different economic and educational backgrounds. That's my LGBT community. So to even think for a minute that I would abandon them for a tax break, or to sit along evangelicals who consistently try to undermine any rights that I fight for, is just so asinine to who I am. And the second part is, and I'm a real believer in this, is that I can't ignore history. In my lifetime, the Republican Party has said terrible things to my community. They've ignored the AIDS crisis until there were, you know, almost 40,000 people dead by the time Reagan said the word AIDS. I can't ignore that. I can't be cajoled back into a party because, you know, the newest the newest guy says, oh, it's okay. So as a gay person, you know, it'll be 100 years before I would even think of voting for a Republican. It's just so far outside my ken. And when gay people talk about it, I get really upset because I think that as gay people right now, we have a really cool vantage point, especially as white cisgendered men in this country, to rather than kind of step into our privilege and think like, oh, well, now we have marriage and we got what we want, to live on the edge of our privilege and really say, no, I see what it's like to be discriminated against. I see what it's like to be counted as a second-class citizen. And because I can see it, I can lend my voice to that and be a support to that. So gay Republicans, it just seems like it's so far outside the reaches of my moral compass and my thoughtful mind that I can't respect them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they were here in Cleveland a few weeks ago for the RNC, and it was something.
Course.
Yeah,
and they're sitting around and saying, you know, oh, we're really making progress. The RNC came down with one of the worst LGB platforms in 10 years.
Yeah.
So no, they're not.
Yeah.
They're not. They're expecting these guys to turn around and say, oh, well, you two, you know, we didn't mean it. You know what? Words and actions mean things. And not that the Democrats are perfect, but at least, you know, my joke is nobody ever joined the Nazi party for the boots.
Right.
But I have no patience for that.
There it is. There it is. All right, let's do one more topic. Let's move on to let's move on to happier things. Is there a more fun night of the year than the night of 1,000 Judys?
Well, I'll tell you, not for me.
Yeah.
Not for me. It's my favorite night. It becomes a season for us because we're all, you know, ramping up and getting ready for this amazing performance. And it touches on the cornerstone of what the show is and what the show's always been. And I know I said this before, but really at the center of the meeting and everything that I've done with it is this sense of community. And when we were first coming up with the show and when we were first kind of making, you know, making our stride or kind of making it happen, even that first year, we did a benefit for the Ali Fournay Center, which houses LGBT youth in New York. Because even though we didn't make any money and we weren't making any money from the show then, because the show is anchored in community, and if we didn't give something back, we weren't being true to what the show is. So every year for the last 6 years, now will be 7, we've done Night of 1,000 Judys, which celebrates Judy Garland as an icon. And we get amazing performers from Broadway and downtown again. And again, it's not an imitation of her, but it is them interpreting her work in new and exciting ways. So for me, it's, you know, as somebody who is so, I love Judy and kind of go back to her all the time as a performer, it's a way of celebrating her and keeping her alive, but also seeing how she's interpreted by new and interesting artists. And at the end of the night, we make a lot of money for housing homeless LGBT kids, which has become a passion of mine, and working with the Ali Fournay Center for these few years and seeing the amazing work that they do and being part of it in some small way is just, it's the icing on top of a perfect night.
You just lost your street cred for saying you're not an activist, just so you know.
Oh, sorry. I'll work on it.
Okay. I'm just saying. Tell our listening audience what you have coming up that you are excited about.
Well, let's see. Right now I'm working on my third season of Two Broke Girls here in Hollywood. Which I write for. And then we're kicking off the new season of The Meeting in September, our last season. I have my second book coming out next year, early next year, and two new plays coming out by the end of the year. So hopefully there'll be lots more work that you'll see from me coming up.
Love it. Love it. Listeners, this is what you need to go do. So many things you need to go do. Stroll on over to internationalorderofsodomites.com and you can learn all about the meeting. You can learn all about Justin. You can stroll on over to anywhere where fine books are sold and pick up Husky, an extraordinarily enjoyable young adult novel. Go on over to iTunes, download The Gay Agenda. And of course, while you're hanging out over there on iTunes, you need to subscribe to Sparkle and Circulate with Justin Serre. This is what I have to say about you, sir. I have only said this a handful of times over the many years that I've been doing this. You really are an original. You have this approach and this take on our community, on comedy, on entertaining, that when people witness what it is that you do, you are an original. You're certainly a Renaissance man, and you have so many different outlets, but I love and am so inspired by what it is that you put out there to the world, because it is an original voice. It really inspires me, Justin.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot. Thank you so much. And I'm single. So if anyone listens, you know, just putting it out there.
There it is.
I'm very single, and I made some money. So
okay.
Just, checking all my bases.
Justin, please keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. I will. And you as well. This show is fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on.
There ain't nothing I can do or nothing I can say that folks don't criticize me. But I'm going to do just as I want to anyway, and don't care just what people say.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news out there. But first, let's do a final wrap-up of Cleveland Pride. So yes, it was canceled maybe 2 weeks ago, and I wrote a piece about that, and it went a little crazy, and people all over the world were saying, you can't cancel a Pride. Well, the good thing was people here in Cleveland were also saying, you can't cancel a Pride. So the LGBT Center of Greater Cleveland brought together 17 or 18 different organizations, and they put on Pride in the CLE. They put it together in 13 days. If you guys are out there thinking, I can't possibly do things in a short amount of time, what can possibly be accomplished if we're not working on it the whole year? The answer to you, the shining example, your inspiration for the day, Pride in the CLE, a group of individuals working on a citywide event for 13 days. And what resulted? So it started out, there was a march, and we just didn't know how many people were going to show up, and we certainly didn't know. It has been blazing hot here in Cleveland for months now. There has been nary a drop of rain to be found anywhere. It has really not been good for my shrubbery outside the front of my house. Not good at all. Needs some moisture. Well, of course, it has not rained at all except, well, look at that forecast. Looks like it's going to rain for Pride. It looked like it was going to be torrential downpours by maybe 9 or 10 a.m. And then the forecast kept changing, which was a lovely thing. So we did the march in the morning. Over 1,200 people showed up to do the march, which was lovely. So my partner Rich and I were towards the front because I had to get down to the festival first, and we'll talk about that in a second. We marched to the front, and it was glorious. There are tons of pictures online. If you just Google Pride in the CLE, you will see tons of photos. You will likely see Rich and I towards the front there. And we walked across a major bridge here in Cleveland. It's called the Detroit Superior Bridge. And we walked across that bridge, and there was no cars because the police were leading us through, mounted police, which was sort of fun. And there were indeed people who were lining the bridge to watch us march. Not tons and tons of people, because those tons and tons of people were somewhere else. I'll tell you that too in a second. But just walking down that major bridge into downtown Cleveland, holding Rich's hand, waving an Equality Ohio flag, it was glorious. It wasn't about how many people were watching. It's not about getting on the news. Though visibility is wonderful and visibility is super, super important, in that moment, it was about us. It was about me as an individual feeling proud and walking there. It was about Rich and I holding hands and just being out in the world. And it was about a community, 1,248 people marching together. It was incredible. Well, we crossed the bridge, and the bridge leads into downtown Cleveland. And I was a little bit thinking, oh gosh, there's just not going to be that many people here. When we got to the end of the bridge, there were some Westboro people. I don't know that they were actually from the Westboro Baptist Church, but they were certainly people with not very nice signs. Only maybe 3 to 5 of them. Not many folks. But a little disappointed to see there. Well, a couple individuals from a local church sprang into action, and they were prepared for this. One of them, I'm giving her a shout out, one of my students, Joanna Smith, and a couple other people, 5 folks dressed as angels with those large outstretched wings. And just like they did at Matthew Shepard's funeral, they stood in front of the protesters so that all of the marchers could walk by them, and they were completely obstructed. It was beautiful. I've seen pictures of things like that happening, but actually seeing it in person, we cheered like crazy. Well, when we crossed that bridge into downtown Cleveland, then it changed a bit because suddenly there were thousands of people. When we were walking across the bridge, Rich and I actually said, oh, not that many people watching. That's okay, because it's not about the other people right this second. But it really changed when we got into downtown Cleveland, and there were thousands and thousands of people. It was glorious. It was absolutely glorious. You could feel it in the air. There was such a beautiful energy. Well, I got changed real quick from my t-shirt with cut-off sleeves because we were in the baking sun doing that half-mile walk. Got changed into a shirt and tie and shorts because it was still pretty hot, and got up on that stage and I emceed the festival for about 5 or 6 hours. It was incredible. The rain held out for so long. I mean, really, I thought it was going to downpour at 11 and then 12 and then 1 and 2. It held off until 4:30 p.m., which was amazing, but we'll get to the rain in a second. So many elected officials came, which is such a great display of support. So city councilmen came, our state representative, Nikki Antonio, who's a wonderful out representative that we have here in Cleveland. She does such incredible work. The mayor just showed up, Mayor Frank Jackson. I didn't know he was going to come. I think a lot of people didn't know he was going to show up. He just showed up, so I introduced him to the crowd. It was so much fun. Musical acts, speakers, people who gave the history of Pride, indie singer-songwriters, some incredible fierce drag queens. There were local LGBT and statewide organizations who had tables, and they reported just doing incredible sign-up business. Incredible numbers of people signing up for mailing lists to get more information about the work that they do. Food trucks, people standing in front of the stage, listening to every word. It was amazing. Well, we got to about 4:30. The skies definitely started getting darker. Trying to hold out. And then no, the skies opened up and it was a torrential downpour. We only got cut off by about 2 hours. Really, I cannot believe we made it that far because the weather forecast in the morning was that it was going to be just plain terrible. But at that point, it became clear we probably need to stop now. So we had to stop, packed everything up. Rich and I walked back across the bridge and just felt great. The wonderful thing was seeing everybody's posts on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, people just having the most amazing time, feeling like this was a real community event. And it was all buoyed by the fact that look what we put together in 13 days. 13 days. So I would like to say that the drama of Cleveland Pride is now over. And indeed, 2016, that is now over, and that's wonderful. Unfortunately, just to give you guys the scoop and the inside scoop, the organization that canceled Pride, Cleveland Pride Inc., during the Pride in the CLE festival, they posted a Facebook event, a save the date for next year. So the big question now is going to be, who hosts Pride for 2017? I understand that people don't want to answer this right now. I kind of want to get the drama out of the way because I think it is going to be drama. I think the community is going to have to come together and decide, who do we want hosting this event? Because the group that was supposed to host the event, they failed miserably. They canceled it for an entire city. But other people feel like, well, it shouldn't be the LGBT Center because those are paid employees and not volunteers. So it's going to be a thing. I want the thing done as soon as possible because I want as much time to elapse as possible between the drama of Pride and the actual Pride of 2017. I will most certainly keep you posted. Exciting stuff here in Cleveland. The important thing was we all came together. It was a glorious day. A glorious day. Let's get to the news out there. There is a school that has new guidelines for teachers, and it is causing a bit of a kerfuffle. A new presentation, Transgender 101, shown to principals and school staff, hopes to make schools more sympathetic to transgender students. This is a good thing. This is where we're trying to make our schools more inclusive. These are new guidelines in North Carolina schools. The school's new guidelines for teachers, they're proving controversial, advising teachers not to use boys or girls, the words boys or girls. Some of the advice given includes allowing transgender students to go on trips conforming with the gender they identify with. For example, trans girls will be allowed to attend an all-girl hike. Other guidelines advise teachers to use nouns like students or scholars rather than boys and girls, and to be cautious about not outing students to classmates or fellow teachers. Teachers are also taught about offensive language and to avoid words like tranny and transgender. Within the presentation, a gender unicorn is used to illustrate concepts like gender, genderqueer, gender nonconforming, and other variations within sexuality and gender. The concept was developed by Trans Student Educational Resources, whose purpose is to create a trans-friendly education system. They were created back in 2014. Unsurprisingly, the information was misrepresented by conservative outlets. A writer for Fox News implied the new program would put girls at risk of young boys whose hormones would be at, quote, peak levels while in schools. Oh my. While a guideline suggests teachers consider carefully any situation where students express concerns on gender or sexuality before going to their parents, the same journalist said it was the same as asking parents, quote, to be left out of their child's gender decision making. Not at all. Not at all. Other conservative bloggers called it, quote, the stuff of nightmares and described this organization as, quote, sick perverts. Yeah. All we're trying to do, folks, is make schools safer. That's all we're trying to do. And these are little tiny tweaks to make schools safer. So that's what's going on in North Carolina. How about Target? Target has announced plans to introduce single stall bathrooms in all of its stores that don't already have one. Huge news. Despite a campaign started earlier this year to boycott the brand over their commitment to trans bathroom rights, the company is now investing more than $20 million to roll out single-stall bathrooms across the United States. The company's chief financial officer, Kathy Smith, made the announcement this week. A spokesperson for Target, Katie Boylan, told reporters that the brand already has single-stall bathrooms available to use by anyone in 1,400 out of the 1,800 stores. So that's just something people should know that I suspect a lot of people don't know. Announced earlier this year, the big box brand's bathroom policy allows people to use the restroom or fitting room facility that corresponds with their gender identity. Over 1.2 million people across the U.S. threatened to boycott Target over the policy. Boylan said that the brand had received very mixed feedback from its customers, some who are very, very supportive, others who are not. She said this, quote, the impact to the business is not material at this time. She went on to say that the decision to install lockable single-stall bathrooms in all of their stores came because, quote, we are listening. Some get it, some like it, some don't. We are committed. There you go. Target. Target leading the way. How about some news from across the pond? A Scottish member of parliament was left baffled after being questioned why he would want to share a bed with his partner in a New York hotel. Huh. Stuart McDonald, who was in New York City on holiday with his partner, checked into the Hotel Pennsylvania after their flight back to the UK was delayed. Upon arriving at the check-in desk, this politician was asked if the double room with one bed was correct, and when he said it was, he was then asked, quote, really? Both of you in the same bed? Well, speaking to Pink News, the Glasgow politician said, quote, we were due to fly home at 11 p.m. on the 15th of August, but after an incident at JFK last night, our flight has been delayed until the 16th, so we booked another hotel for one night near to where we were staying. Upon seeing we had only booked a double room with one bed, the receptionist queried if this was correct. I told him it was. He then replied, really? Both of you in the same bed? I told him Gordon was my partner. And the receptionist then just stood and stared at us for a few seconds before proceeding to check us in. He was clearly baffled and uncomfortable with the idea of two men who are in a relationship sharing a bed. Huh. Determined not to let it spoil their trip, Mr. McDonald added that the receptionist's attitude showed how far we still had to go in the fight for LGBT rights. He said this, quote, same-sex couples just shouldn't have to go through this sort of stuff in 2016. I intend to write to the hotel about the incident once I have returned home. Pink News contacted the hotel in regards to the incident, but had yet to receive a reply at the time of publication. That has happened to my partner and I countless times. Countless times we have gone to a hotel and they have only had twin beds available or two double beds available, and we've requested one bed, and we've had those moments of, really? That's what you want? Yes, that's what we want. We would like to share one bed. That's what we do here in the house. This isn't I Love Lucy style where we have separate beds. Nope. We want one bed. So, yeah, still some work to do. So whoever's out there training all your receptionists, please train them to not be baffled when two men or two women want the same bed. So that's there in New York City. In New Jersey, right next door, the state of New Jersey is facing a challenge over a law that says lesbians wanting a baby should try having sex with men. Under the state's current legal statutes, infertility is defined as when a woman cannot conceive after a year or more of unprotected intercourse with a man. Due to this, a number of lesbians have found themselves rejected for coverage by their insurers, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, when seeking fertility treatment. Erin and Marianne Krupa were forced to spend more than $50,000 on infertility treatment after their insurance claim was rejected under the law. They had previously suffered six miscarriages. They are joined in the case by two other women, Sol Mejas and Sarah Mills. Lawyer Grace Catherine Kretcher, an attorney representing the four women in the case, told Reuters that the legal definition of infertility should not be phrased to exclude lesbians. Susan Summer, a spokeswoman for Lambda Legal, added this, quote, this lawsuit reflects the frustration and indignities lesbian and gay people endure because state laws and insurance rules continue to presume the only parents are heterosexual parents. One of the women, Marianne Krupa, told WABC-TV this, quote, right away we were told that without having heterosexual sexual intercourse, we would not be covered. Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield said this in a statement, quote, Horizon covers infertility services equally regardless of sexual orientation. We interpret the 2001 New Jersey law defining infertility in a gender and orientation neutral manner, and our coverage standard complies with federal non-discrimination requirement. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, you know, a prominent supporter of Donald Trump, recently attacked a grandstanding boycott of North Carolina over the state's anti-LGBT law. After the NBA recently confirmed it would be moving its 2017 All-Star Game out of the state, he fumed, are they going to evaluate every law in every state, or is it just a certain law? I know what it is. It's grandstanding by the NBA, and that's what they do. So I'm not sure how much support Governor Christie is going to be in the change that is sought in the great state of New Jersey, my home state of New Jersey. In faith-based news, five pastors in the U.S. are suing a state over a law which bans gay cure therapy, reparative therapy. The pastors suggest that gay cure therapy is effective and argue that it should not be banned. The church leaders in Illinois are from Pastors Protecting Youth, and they say that clergy members should be exempt from a law which bans gay cure or conversion therapy for minors. The Youth Mental Health Protection Act, of 2016, just this year, bans therapy which represents same-sex attraction, quote, as a mental disease, disorder, or illness. Pastor Stephen Stultz of New Church Apostolic Ministries of East Garfield said this, quote, in 1 Corinthians 6:9, the Apostle Paul writes to those who had overcome many sins, including homosexuality, stating, such were some of you, but you were changed through God's healing. I have personally witnessed many people change their sexual orientation through counseling and know it's possible. The government is interfering into someone's private decisions. This ban on counseling creates fear in the people most in need of comfort and support, end quote. They have retained a lawyer who said this, quote, we are most concerned about young people who are seeking the right to choose their own identity. This is an essential human right. However, this law undermines the dignity and integrity of those who choose a different path for their lives than politicians and activists prefer. Each person should be free to receive biblical and spiritual counseling from the pastor of their choice to help them orient their sexuality. Yeah, here's the problem, folks. It actually doesn't work. How many times can I say this? I say this, I feel like week in, week out on this show. Conversion therapy, reparative therapy. Not only does it not work, all of our medical associations have said this does not work, but it actually does harm. So, is it possible that that pastor has encountered someone who says, oh yes, I've changed? We need to look at why that person is saying it. First of all, the person has not changed, and check back with that person probably in a short amount of time if they're asserting that. Also, there is all the pressure within the faith-based world, particularly in this conservative faith-based world, where possibly your parents are not going to support you anymore, to say, yes, I've changed. Of course that pressure exists. That doesn't mean that the sexual orientation of a minor, and we are talking about minors, have changed. So, even though only just a few states, 6 or 7 states out of 50, have outlawed this very harmful practice, even in those 6 states, there are people fighting against the ban on conversion therapy. Can we do good news? We need some good news. The mayor of Atlanta, Kasim Reed, has made a historic appointment to the city's Atlanta Citizen Review Board. Mayor Reed appointed an out trans person to the board, praising their lifelong activism. The appointment is believed to be the first time a trans person has served on the board openly. Mayor Reed said this in a written statement, quote, I am pleased to appoint Tracy McDaniel to serve on the Atlanta Citizen Review Board. As a lifelong advocate for the transgender community, Ms. McDaniel will bring an important perspective and a lifetime of experience to this role. He added that he thought that the appointment would be useful amid tensions between police and Atlanta residents. He said this, quote, giving them a role on this body, I think, amplifies that voice and informs us. The Atlanta Review Board was originally created during allegations that the city's police force had used excessive force. The mayor said this, quote, the Citizens Review Board is very important, and I think a lot of people are talking about it as a national model. The LGBT community in the city, of course, celebrated the move. Cheryl Courtney Evans, the executive director of Transgender Individuals Living Their Truth, she told local news that the appointment, quote, is more than just window dressing. McDaniel has previously served on the LGBT Advisory Board for the Atlanta Police Department and is a vetted trainer for the United States Department of Justice. Bravo. Bravo, Atlanta. Very well done. Very well done. So I'm a little bit nervous about saying the story because I don't want to revel in someone's misfortune, but there is a bit of irony here. Tony Perkins, we've talked about him so many times over the past 8 years, president of the anti-gay religious lobbying group, the Family Research Council. Well, he unfortunately had his home destroyed by the massive flooding ravaging southern Louisiana this week. Our thoughts are with all of our brothers and sisters who are trying to navigate through that horrible, horrible tragedy. Although no one wants to celebrate a person losing their home, the destruction of Tony Perkins' house isn't without irony, considering that he has claimed in the past that natural disasters are God's way of punishing an increasingly gay-friendly world. Calling into his own radio show, Perkins described the flood as being, quote, of biblical proportions. He added that he and his family will have to live in a camper for 6 months until the damage is repaired, but he was careful to point out that this particular flood Not other ones, but this one was not because of the gays, but rather, quote, an incredible, encouraging spiritual exercise to take you to the next level in your walk with an almighty and gracious God who does all things well. That's right. Tony Perkins called in to his own radio show to distinguish this flood from all other floods. This isn't an anti-gay flood. This is a spiritual testing flood. Because this spiritual testing flood, unlike the anti-gay floods, destroyed his home. Huh. Last year, he had as a guest on his radio show Christian, quote, prophet Jonathan Kahn, who claimed that Hurricane Joaquin was a sign of God's wrath for the legalization of gay marriage. Perkins agreed, saying that while those on the left like to mock these things, many throughout history know that God is trying to send us a message through natural disasters. But again, not this recent one. This recent one, that's a spiritual test. All of the other floods, they're anti-gay. Huh. Last story for you. Speaking at a Donald Trump rally in Kissimmee, Florida this week, a gay man who said he lives just 1 mile from the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, he shamed President Obama for visiting the city beautiful in the wake of the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. Randy Ross, who last year ran unsuccessfully for mayor of Orlando, said he was troubled by the president's visit to Orlando 4 days after the Pulse nightclub massacre. He said this, quote, "The death of 49 innocent people was an attack on the gay community. It was an attack on the Hispanic community. But moreover, it was an attack on Americans." He then slammed the tone and the content of the speech the president gave 4 days after the shooting at that makeshift memorial outside Pulse. He said this, quote, "While victims were in the hospital, families were grieving, funeral arrangements were being made for the victims. Our city mourning, President Obama turned the conversation into one of gun control. President Obama, guns are not the problem." So, there you go. In our earlier conversation with the great and original Justin Sayre, here are the gay Republicans. They are here. They are in front of microphones. They are being heard. We can't just completely ignore them, but we need to have strategies for responding to them swiftly and immediately. So that is all the news we have for this week's show. Our huge, huge thanks to Justin Sayre. That was, I know, a lot of laughing on my part. That is one entertaining guy. That is one entertaining guy. Check out all of the amazing things he's doing. Go pick up his book. Go subscribe to his podcast. Go download his comedy album if you're in New York City. Go get tickets to go see him at the meeting. Very enjoyable stuff. And of course, thanks to you all, as always, for your support. Get on out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. I don't know what you best do. Whether it's taking 13 days to plan a parade, whether it's making your own comedy album, whether it's writing a letter to the editor, whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference, go do it. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
If I should take the notion to jump into the ocean, ain't nobody's business if I do. If I go to church on Sunday, then cabaret all day Monday, ain't nobody's business if I do. Man ain't got no money, and I say take all of mine, honey. Ain't nobody's business if I do.